You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Following the release of the budget and the reports that thousands more civil servants will be losing their jobs to right-size the government, a bill quickly passed under urgency to allow the automated decision-making throughout the social welfare system. The Social Security Modernization Amendment Bill was passed without the normal consultation processes as it was sped through Parliament. With the national-led government reforming our welfare system to enable automated decision-making, there are concerns that we may find ourselves in a similar scandal to the robo-debt issue in Australia. So, to understand this, I reached out to the visiting fellow at the Australian University Crawford School of Public Policy, Dr. Jacob Priegaard, to talk about what happened in Australia when they enabled automated decision-making and how we could avoid it here. To begin with, what is the robo-debt controversy? How did it begin? What were its intentions initially?
Robodebt was the name given to a welfare compliance program run by Australia's Welfare Service Delivery Agency. It began in the 2015-16 budget, and its intention was to save $1.7 billion over 5 years by pulling that money back from welfare recipients through automation. So the way it worked was by comparing fortnightly social security records of current and past recipients with their annualized tax office returns. So when the system noted that there was a discrepancy between those numbers, a letter was automatically generated that contacted the recipient at their last known address and asked them to disprove that discrepancy. If they could not do so, a subsequent letter was sent with a debt notice. So there's some obvious problems in that it reversed the onus of proof from the government to the recipient. So rather than the government proving a debt as it used to in the previous human-run model, the recipient had to disprove the debt by going back to past employers to highlight their earnings or any information they could get to show that the numbers the government had were incorrect. This disproportionately affected people who had inconsistent patterns of work, which described more than 90% of people on welfare in Australia. So the scheme came under enormous pressure very quickly, in part because the use of automation to generate that savings had increased the amount of reviews under this scheme from 20,000 human reviews a year to 20,000 automated reviews per week. So that resulted in two Senate inquiries, two ombudsman investigations, and eventually a class action lawsuit in which the scheme was deemed illegal. And that resulted in the largest compensation payout by a Commonwealth government in Australian history of more than $1 billion. That was followed by a Royal Commission that gave astonishing insight into how the scheme was put together and that there was little to no consideration of how to safeguard vulnerable people. This was partly evidenced by reports of suicides in response to some of the debt letters that occurred back in 2017 and 2018. So the scheme ran in total for nearly 5 years. Even while all those investigations were occurring.
Now, at the end of it all, how would you say robo-debt is considered within the Australian mind?
It's led to a large lack of trust in government services. One of the distinctive things that occurred was that with vulnerable people receiving letters or these debt notices, a lot of people just assumed that they were correct, even though that we now know that as many as 30% of them were not actually true debts. The way that the algorithm and the automated calculation was working was coming up with incorrect debts. So people were so scared and terrified of the debts and that debt collectors would be coming after them that they were just paying the debts. To then find out afterwards that the entire scheme and the stress that they were put under was actually illegal, it's just generated a real collapse in trust of government services and in the social security system. In terms of the politics of the question, the Labor Party that's in government now ran the Royal Commission into the scheme, and they've generally been of the view that the scheme was illegal, it was problematic, and that we need to reduce the amount of compliance work that we do in the welfare system and be more careful about automation. The coalition that was in government at the time has generally taken the point of view that the specific way the debts were calculated was the problem and that was illegal, but there was nothing ethically wrong with chasing vulnerable people for debts.
How did the story sort of break? When did it start sort of coming out and people started to understand that there was a problem here?
So the story kind of broke very quickly. So in early 2017, shortly after, like mere months after the thing had been released, it started to generate a lot of traffic in online communities that there was something strange going on here and that these debt notices were different. And it was particularly generating traffic because it was pushing everybody towards online systems. So people were trying to figure out, who do I contact to talk about this? Because I don't understand it. Because the scheme looked back initially 5 years and then 7 years, so it was looking at people who had past debts. So, you know, in 2017, you receive a letter and you'd last been on welfare in 2013, and you're receiving a letter that says that in 2013, you actually were incorrectly paid Social Security and you owe the government money. You might have to then go back to who you were employed by in 2013, whether or not that business still exists or anybody knows you who still works there, and ask them for records of your employment at that business in order to then take those records to Centrelink. So that very quickly started to generate a lot of noise. The government kind of played that down initially, started saying this is, you know, a new program, there's new processes in place, it's just teething issues, everything's legal, it's legislated, it's fine. The pressure built over a large period of time, and it was generally just contested by the political class and the public service. So there was a Senate inquiry followed by an ombudsman inquiry, which the departments worked with and gave information to. That resulted in some curtailing of the, you know, the worst excesses. So a phone number was added, additional support was put in place that people could contact somebody to talk about their situation. But the scheme still kept on running with the same automatic assumptions of discrepancies. That led to a second Senate inquiry, a second ombudsman investigation, and it was only shut down once the court deemed the scheme illegal. And it was that illegality that actually shut the whole thing down, and that illegality that spawned the Royal Commission. Because at that point in time, the question then becomes, like, how is an illegal policy created in the first place? So the inquiry was very much legalistic, much more than ethical. It was very focused on how did the illegal thing happen, rather than asking why we're creating schemes worth billions of dollars to recoup money from the most vulnerable people in the community.
I think it's worth noting that, as you said in the beginning, there's that flipping that happened from the onus being on the government to prove that this fraud was going on to it being upon all the people that were getting these reports. Diving into those calculations, could you illustrate to us how these things were going wrong?
Yeah, I think it's worth understanding what automation actually is. Like, in the public discourse, we tend to talk about it in terms of being something that speeds up a process. You know, ministers like to talk about this, making things more efficient, making things quicker for recipients, making things quicker for consumers. From a public policy point of view, we would look at that a little differently. And we would say what automation is actually doing is it is about removing discretion from frontline workers in order to save those costs. So the efficiency is by having an automated system do the work instead of someone actually talking to a recipient in person. Now, the removal of discretion has benefits and has negatives, right? If you take away more discretion for a frontline worker who's talking to somebody, you end up with largely a more consistent service. But where you have people who have more complex cases, you end up with worse service and you are more likely to do harm to those people. So if you think about the case of RoboDebt, those 20,000 reviews that were happening per year in the previous system, while still large-scale compliance and, you know, trying to retrospectively take debts from people who may or may not have been supposed to have been receiving welfare before, the onus was on the government and on the frontline worker to work with the person accused of having the debt, to work with their financial institutions, to go back to their employers and figure out if that debt was real. So that discretion that was there was in that investigator and that person on the front line to ensure that there was accuracy in the system. There is a human oversight there. Once you move to RoboDebt, the automation component and the bit that was delivering that large saving was removing that discretion. It was removing that frontline worker from that part of the process, and a frontline worker would only become involved if the person contested the debt. So one of the key lessons I would take out of it is, where do you put human oversight in an automation process? It's one thing to talk about safeguarding, but if your safeguard is at the end of the process as it was in RoboDebt, the person has already received a discrepancy letter, which they may or may not have answered or been able to adequately respond to through digital channels, which I might add were the only channels available. and then they've received a debt letter, and then they've challenged, and then the human oversight has begun. So where you put the safeguard and the human component into that automated system is really critical. And it's especially critical in a situation where you're dealing with vulnerable people who, as I said before, will tend to assume that the system is correct about their information instead of assuming that the system is 70% correct and could be largely wrong.
It seems intuitive that if it's all online, the people who are most vulnerable are the least equipped to chase up a system like this. Whereas if you were going in to see a caseworker, they can help you resolve problems or help you understand what's happening. If things happened to go down a route that was similar to this in the New Zealand context, what would New Zealand need to prevent or recognise that something was going wrong and then fix that?
Look, there's a few things that probably need to be in place, but one is really clear vulnerability indicators inside the social security system. We didn't actually know in Australia how vulnerable the people being contacted were. So automated letters going to someone who's already dealing with significant mental health harms and challenges in other spaces led to suicides. The assumption going in was that the vulnerability indicators on social security records in Australia were sufficient and were in place, that vulnerable people weren't being contacted. They turned out to not be anywhere near as robust as what the government thought they were. I think real cognizance of where the human oversight is in the process. It's not enough to say there will be human oversight. Human oversight has to be at the right times and has to adequately cover for those vulnerabilities. So I think there's a real implementation challenge here about where you put the human in the process and which parts of that process they check in on and double check. The thing I would go back to more than anything else, though, that seems to sometimes be missed here is the complexity of the social security system in the first place. One of the reasons that all those debts were being generated in Australia and in the Netherlands is because the system was heavily means tested and very complicated. So the system was so hard to navigate that people were making mistakes left and right and didn't understand exactly what their rights were and exactly what they were engaging with. So those debts only existed because the system was so complicated in the first place. Automation is a about removing discretion from frontline workers, and there is a genuine conversation, civic conversation there for people in New Zealand to think about how much discretion you want your frontline workers to have. How important is it that your frontline workers can give personalized service to vulnerable people versus having a system that is, say, faster but automated that doesn't give that personalized support? Because I think that's the trade-off that's being made, and they're legitimate questions to be asking for a government, and they're legitimate questions for a population to think about and discuss.
That was Dr. Jacob Puregard, Australia University's Crawford School of Public Policy, pardon me, discussing the disastrous robo-debt scandal in Australia, what we need to look for in New Zealand as the government automates decision-making, and the necessity to interrogate decisions that target the worst off and most vulnerable to claw back money.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.